It's started, you could say, many, many years ago. And in fact, I got a good, I guess, cop story before I tell you about all these bad ones, because it certainly didn't start with the big scene that we have around us today. 8 years ago, I didn't know anyone in Victoria. I moved here in a van when I started all this stuff. And a few months later began the Cannabis Buyers Club, where I began to help people with permanent physical medical problems gain access to cannabis and cookies and other cannabis products. And we worked for, I think it was about 3 years before the first time the police actually caught me at a hempology meeting. And I was at Bastion Square. There was only about 20 people. Dan was there, I remember. There's probably maybe other people that were there. But remember that four cops came around the corner. They caught, was it you with the pipe, or Crystal? No, you with the pipe in your mouth? Was it Dan? And were you not there in Bastion Square? You're too stoned to remember. Oh, you were passing to Scott. Okay, because my friend Scott got caught with a joint. I sort of remember you being there, our friend Crystal. Morgan, wasn't Morgan there too? Were you telling the cops, oh, search me, like, yeah. They wanted to search us. They caught two people with joints or pipes and were threatening to search, like, the whole group. Again, it was 5 years ago, so hempology was only about 20 or 25 people. It was after I was done talking, and the cops surprised us. So anyway, they had two people for possession, and I thought, well, gee, this is no fair that people are getting busted at hempology, and it's not me. I started this shit. So I was telling the cops what was going on, and they saw, I guess, zigzag papers in my coat, thought they should search me. And I had roaches in my pocket and a pipe and stuff. So I thought, okay, fine. It's a small price to pay to fight in court with my friends here. And the police proceeded to ask me a few more questions about what I was doing. And when they realized how serious I was and my intentions to strike down the prohibition law, that one of them said to me, there's a lot of, you know, people making a lot of money off of this, and they don't want to see it legalized. Aren't you afraid that, you know, if you start to become successful, that one of these people is going to just, you know, shoot you or something? And I looked at the police and I said, well, don't you have your life on the line when you do your job? Do you believe in what you're doing as much as I believe in what I'm doing now? And the police officers just didn't have a response, and they left that night. The other funny part was, I remember telling them I look forward to going to court and swearing to tell the truth on the Bible, and that I would proceed to go through the Bible and explain the history of prohibition contained therein. And when we went to court, finally, Scott and I, no one was being processed at all, and he didn't even show up, and I was kind of frustrated. But that was kind of how it started, and sort of even sets the tone for how the police have reacted with me and otherwise ever since. With that incident, there's actually 12 different times now where either me or a friend have been arrested at a hempology meeting or at the Cannabis Buyers Club. There's not a single conviction that stands in court from any one of those 12 police incidents. And four of those times the charges have been delayed for my constitutional challenge. But we're certainly proud of our record in court, though we don't quite yet have protection against the police. But that started, the police actually came on really heavy, you might say, at the University of Victoria, November 8th, 2000. I certainly had some warning. A security guard told me 2 weeks earlier that if I persisted in going to the university and smoking joints with students, that I could be charged with trafficking. And I told her that I knew that, and that I thought that was the stupidest law in the country, and again, I would be glad to stand before a judge and challenge that particular law. And she told me, well, you know, I'm doing my job, I gotta report that to the university administration. And I'm like, well, we all got a job to do, don't we? You know, have a good day, see you next week. And I don't think it was the week after I got arrested. It was 2 weeks after they sent four undercover police officers to a University of Victoria Hempology 420 meeting that happens every week. And one of those officers pretended to take a toke, put the rest of the joint in his pocket, and that's the evidence that they have against me, that I was trafficking, I guess, a total of 7 joints that day. But instead of arresting me when I passed the first joint to the first person or when he got the joint in his hand, they decided to wait until long after the meeting and arrest me in the parking lot afterwards, charged me with trafficking, possession for the purpose, because I had some left, and banned me from the campus, was certainly the intentions of the administration. And I guess without getting into more detail per se about the rest, there are certainly other questionable factors that come in that the police violated my rights with. One of them being, get this one, they actually kept my amplifier and microphone because they told me it was an accessory to my crime of trafficking, because I told everybody over the microphone that I was about to light a joint and share it with them if they came over to the circle. And therefore, it was an important part of my criminal act. And so they kept the first amplifier that I ever bought. They gave me back the lighter that I used to light all the joints. I probably should have kept it and put it up on the wall. But anyway, they certainly were irrational in many of their behaviors and how they arrested me. And it was, in fact, so arbitrary, which means, you know, not equal or not fair, that I was treated differently or discriminated against. That's the judge, when we presented what's called a constitutional question, immediately recognized that my rights had probably been violated enough in this incident to justify what's called a constitutional question notice. Before I get to that, though, I guess the other thing I got caught for that was added to that was my annual pot cookie giveaway, or the annual pot cookie giveaway that happens on November 15th of every year. So I was arrested for the cookie giveaway as well. And the two arrests, again, were questionable enough that that I was granted this constitutional challenge that I'll talk more about. I need to backtrack now to tell you, per se, the next character in this, which is Judge Smith, who I said I'd be in front of again tomorrow. The first time I got to meet Judge Smith was when I was getting out of jail for the cookie giveaway. And I've never actually had anyone in my life as mad at me, I think, as that judge was on that day. Partly because the Crown Prosecutor was reading a newspaper article out of Victoria News where I was talking about the fact that I was selling medical marijuana, that I just got busted for sharing joints up at UVic, that I was going to go ahead with a pot cookie giveaway anyway, and that I was really looking forward to challenging this ridiculous law in court. And of course the judge, per se, not of course, but the judge was upset at the fact that I'm seen as flaunting the law in many ways here, and the continual public, per se, breaking of the law and advertising almost even in the newspaper was something that really quite upset him. And he waved his finger at me for a few minutes, telling me that if I was caught with cannabis again, or if I tested positive to a piss test, or doing anything wrong, that I'd be kept in jail till the conclusion of all of my trials. Now, I should tell you who Administrative Judge Smith is, because he's per se an important figure in my case and in the courthouse. The administrative judge of a courthouse does two basic jobs, really. He can makes up some rules for the court. Different courthouses have got different rules depending on how many security guards they got or other stuff like that. Some of them are procedures. They have a certain amount of jurisdiction in their own courthouse, but they also have to make sure the other judges follow the rules a bit too. That's one of their jobs. But the appeal courts per se make sure that they follow the law. The other job that the administrative judge has is that they wake up in the morning, they get to the courthouse, they read all the court cases coming up that day, they look at what judges are available, what courtrooms are available, and decide what judges sit in what room. And because that's his job, Judge Smith likes to sit in courtroom 101, because that's the room where you get out of custody if you spent the night in the police station. It's the room that you enter your plea, whether it's guilty or not guilty. And otherwise, it's the place where you basically come to first, where your case starts to be disclosed. And the judge likes to know who all the people are that are coming out and into the system. So later on, when he's deciding the judge for what court case, he can pick the most appropriate person. And I guess the other thing that the administrative judge can do that I don't think the other judges can do so easily is decide to have proceedings in their private chambers. And so 3 years ago, when we showed up to enter a not guilty plea and tell the judge that we had constitutional issues to bring up, Judge Smith immediately said that he were going to take the proceedings to his private chambers. In fact, two meetings happened in his private chambers where I was not even allowed in there, only my lawyer and the Crown Prosecutor, which meant there was no transcripts. Again, not even being a witness to my own proceedings makes it hard to manage, per se. I even threatened to fire my lawyer and take over the case myself, at least temporarily, so I could be in that room. But he assured me that if I let the judge have these private chamber meetings, it would actually give me potential grounds for appeal later on. In fact, there's so many grounds for appeal later on, it's kind of hard to predict how far this could go in some ways with all the issues. But the judge not only violated my rights by having a meeting in his private chambers and excluding me, but he further at least tried to violate my rights by saying that this constitutional argument that I had about the law being irrational and arbitrary was somehow supposed to occur before and separate from my criminal proceedings, which is, you know, really stupid or irrational, because the reason I was granted a constitutional challenge was because the police acted in such an arbitrary way in the way I was arrested at the university in the first place. So the judge says, look, this is a unique situation. We need to decide whether it's fair to charge someone with trafficking for sharing a joint, whether it's fair for police to participate in what is thought to be a criminal act that's supposed to be harmful and arrest one individual from a group later on instead of when the act was actually occurring. Certainly other constitutional questions come into note, but because I had so many constitutional arguments, and the one really around the arbitrary nature of the law being the most strong, it's one of the fundamental principles of justice in Section 9 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, where it says you're not supposed to be detained or imprisoned arbitrarily by the police. So it's quite clearly written that you're not supposed to be discriminated against in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And again, the judge said, okay, well, you know, you may have been discriminated against here, but you're going to have to prove you were discriminated against without your criminal trial coming into to court. So the constitutional trial proceeded on that note 3 years ago. We got before Judge Higginbotham, which is the best we could have got, because he oversaw the Philip Lucas case with the Compassion Club, where he had John Conroy, one of the best pot lawyers in the country, presenting evidence to him. And so Judge Higginbotham, knowing that our arguments were significant and complex, decided right away agreed with us that he should wait for the Supreme Court of Canada to look at the harm principle argument that's contained in Section 7 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, because there is no use, per se, us taking up court time to argue the harm that cannabis can cause and whether or not it's enough harm to warrant the prohibition laws. That's part of our argument, but the Supreme Court of Canada was looking at that particular issue. They finally decided this past December, 2.5 years ago. We expected it to happen within a short amount of time. In fact, the Crown Prosecutor right now is frustrated and upset at the length of time it's been, and would not have agreed to these constant delays if they knew exactly, I guess, what I was up to, or if they knew how long it would be, although the judge might have agreed to the delays anyway. But certainly, the Crown realizes now that they have bungled by allowing these delays over the years. In fact, in January, when they looked at the situation, they thought, well, gee, if Ted doesn't admit that he was passing out joints and cookies, how can we prove, or how are we supposed to defend the law, or otherwise proceed in court? And so in January, instead of setting up a constitutional hearing, the Crown Prosecutor decided to force Judge Smith to, per se, come out of his private chambers, or at least say what he did in his private chambers 3 years ago in terms of the process that is laid out before us. But in fact, the Crown wants the judge to reconsider that process based on all of the circumstances, not just the length of time, to be sure, but the arguments have become more complicated because during this delay, I've been arrested two more times for the sale of medical marijuana at the Cannabis Buyers Club. And I should really tell that part of the story before I go on with all my court cases here, because again, it makes both my constitutional arguments and my criminal proceedings that much more lengthy and complex. As I said before, over 8 years ago, we began providing medical marijuana here in Victoria with the Cannabis Buyers Club. After I got arrested for the cookie giveaway, I hired somebody else, you could say, or got somebody else to come in and do the distribution for the club, because it was certainly unsafe for me to keep doing that at the time. My friend helped me, and then another person took over. And a few months after that, about 4 months after the cookie arrest, the Victoria police tried to get a warrant to arrest me, and were successful in getting a warrant for a friend of mine who was actually in another apartment space in the building that the Buyers Club ran out of. And so the police showed up Friday at 4:20. We had an apartment full of people smoking pot, and they busted our friends in the place downstairs. And I went down with a bag of garbage to go see what was going on, you could say, and talked to Lars, the officer in charge of the raid. And yeah, if you don't know Darren Lara, as some obviously do, you're lucky. But anyway, Lars actually told me that they knew I was selling medical marijuana in the apartment, that the justice of the peace would not give them a warrant to arrest me for it. But in fact, they had been watching me for a full year at Revenue Canada, where they had an office with drug surveillance people making better money than any of my friends ever have helping me out. Doing surveillance for over a year. And after all that time, they realized, oh boy, he's not doing anything other than medical marijuana really here. And as such, they told me, literally, that they wanted me to stop selling out of the apartment and get a storefront. And so we stopped dealing out of the apartment, and we got a storefront. The biggest mistake of my life was actually naming the store Ted's Books. Just a hint to everyone, if you're ever going to sell something illegal out of a store, don't name it after yourself, please. Learn from my mistakes. They've been expensive, but yeah, Ted's Books is still what the police call it down at the station. They think it's a joke. But anyway, Ted's Books opened up. It'll be 3 years this March, actually, and we operated for about 9 months, and the police knew we were there. There was newspaper articles in Monday Magazine and otherwise. The whole goddamn world knew we were there. But we were helping sick people. And the worst anybody could say about the group was that some really sick, desperate people would come buy pot from us and go resell it to other people. And that's certainly the worst thing that's happened at the group. But it's not that we ignored it. In fact, the first police raid was from someone that I had caught reselling cannabis, and he literally dragged the police in the door to have me shut down for selling pot to sick people because he got caught breaking our rules. And the police know this, there's no doubt about it. And so the accusations that have come out of them that we allow that to occur have been completely unfounded. In fact, we've probably cut off over 200 people for either reselling pot or acting suspicious over the years, and continue to be diligent about that. But Terry Christensen bought the heat on us, that's for sure. And the police, the other problem was, when the cops walked in the door of the store the first time, we had another idiot rolling a joint in the store. And so the cops right away saw pot, and this other guy was screaming, "There's pot everywhere, shut him down." So it's kind of hard to talk the cops out of not arresting everybody at the time. But honestly, if you know enough Jedi mind tricks, sometimes you can talk your way out of just about anything. And while I consented to a search that day, the police did not arrest me or Gary, the guy rolling the joint, or Colby, who was sitting behind the scales smiling 15 minutes later when the cops came in. And so actually Colby's in court with me today too. We can't forget about him. Tomorrow, what am I saying? Seems like it's today, but anyway, tomorrow. But anyway, yeah, it was really funny because the one cop didn't know what the hell to do because he realized he was in a store full of all this craziness. So he called for backup, and while the backup was coming, I got somebody to take about a pound of pot out of the store, so they didn't get that. And then, like, 15 minutes later, the cop finally walked into the distribution room, and there's Colby sitting, the scales are still out, the sample jars are out and everything, just waiting for the next customer, you know. The cop came around the corner just like, "Oh my God, okay, you can come out now." And it was pretty comical. Unlike the second raid, where when Lars came in with the warrant for me in the back room, Colby was again behind the scales. The cops came in the distribution room, told him to get out. He was standing in the store, and the cops were like, "Okay, we're going to search you to see if you have any pot on you." And he looks down, and he starts to, like, shake it all off his shirt because it's just everywhere on him, right? But it was all good. In the movie, we're going to have him picking buds out of his hair and scraping oil off his fingers. We convinced the police officers that they shouldn't press charges. For one, because the police told us to get a store. And so when he called the police station, it was confirmed that they had trouble arresting me before. At first, the cop didn't even know if it was illegal. He thought back then, this was 2 years ago, that medical marijuana was legal. They assumed that we had a license to sell cannabis. And when he first asked me, you know, is this legal? And I had to be honest and say that it wasn't. I said we were waiting for authorization from the government, which was sort of true. I didn't expect it, but we certainly had asked for it. We've been given the official no since then, so I can't say we're waiting to see if we get it. But at the time, we definitely were waiting for that possibility. Health Canada, in fact, really wasn't sure what the hell they were doing back then. They certainly weren't helping sick people, which is why the police, for the most part, over the years, have turned a blind eye to these medical clubs and compassion clubs, because they recognize, at least if the government, if the rest of the government doesn't, that there is a legitimate need here, that cannabis does not cause significant harm to society such that they have to consider it high on the priority list, especially for people that are sick, no doubt about it. So that's why they've tolerated our clubs. It's not because we have licenses, it's because we got a lot of nerve, people with good pot, and a bit of hustle, but and maybe a few brains mixed in. But that's why the clubs exist. But the police didn't know that a few years ago. And we convinced them that because the situation was so questionable, that we would allow them to give a search, but we would not allow them to search if they would press charges. And we sort of had this interesting negotiation occur. And they agreed not to per se shut the club down, that they would seize cannabis, and that they would leave it to the Crown prosecutor to lay charges. And so we showed them how we worked and everything that went on, our smoking room and this. But the only information we really had for them aside from the pot and the price list, is our membership list. There's about 800 at the time, and it's basically just a list of sick people, not much more than that. No financial records, nothing else per se, laundering money or organized crime in any real way. But anyway, we explained to them we didn't have a backup copy of our membership list and that we couldn't work without it. And it was really funny because the police officers actually agreed to give me a lift to the police station. At the end of the raid, we had the pot in the back of the car. I was in the back seat. I didn't have cuffs on, though, so it surprised a lot of people because I was just, like, hopping in the back of the police car. They thought I was being arrested but didn't have cuffs on and stuff because, while this was going on, we had members across the street watching and the news was showing up and all this stuff. But I had to go to the police station where the police officer let me copy the membership list so that we knew all the people that we were trying to sell pot to, so we could get back to work later that afternoon. Police officers literally told members, no, we're not shutting the club down. Yeah, we're doing a raid, but we're not gonna charge anyone. You can just come back later this afternoon. Like, don't freak out here. Don't get mad at me. You know, it's basically what they were saying at times. In fact, the police officer, I was standing in the office in the police station in the back room where all the cops doing their paperwork. With the cop, he did the first page of like 20 pages or whatever of the membership list, and he's like, "I hate these machines. You want to do it?" So I stood there, and he sat down, and I photocopying my membership list while all these other cops were looking over at me like, "The fuck? He's working here now? What's going on?" And we again went back to work that afternoon. The club was, I don't think, shut down for more than 2 hours at that police raid. And the charges got sent in the mail about 4 weeks later. We received these charges and a notice we had to appear in court. We didn't have enough time, though, to do that before the next raid, where things, I guess, took an even steeper curve. By that time, I'd already broken my bail conditions a couple times. Fine, thanks. I guess. But because my charges came in the mail, the fact that I was out on strict bail conditions didn't seem to matter. However, the next police raid was really sleazy. Lars, I guess, caught some guy downtown who said, "Oh yeah, I'm a member of the club. I just bought this out, or quarter, and I'm gonna sell it so I can buy some cocaine." And so Lars used that as evidence to get a warrant to arrest me. Like I said, he didn't want Colby, he didn't want anybody else. Certainly no one else was arrested that was even caught with pot. In fact, it's really funny. So I'm in the back room of the store, and what had kind of happened leading up to my second biggest mistake, I guess, was with the first police raid, we lost about 8,000 or 9,000 in pot and cash. So I was in a lot of debt, so the group borrowed a lot of pot, you could say, to get out of debt from the first police raid. And so there's like $20,000 worth in the store for the second raid. The second biggest mistake of my life, that's for sure. And it was to the point where when Lars came in, I was in the back of the store, and there was a grower there with a quarter pound of pot in his hands, and the price was dropping every 5 minutes, and I was just like, "No, man, I can't take it." And he said, "Oh, but..." And anyway, Lars came in the back, and he's got the warrant, and he just grabs a bag of pot, and he's like, get out into the store." So we went out there, and they told everybody we're going to get searched. And I kind of thought I was in a lot of trouble, honestly, for a lot of reasons, I guess. Certainly my name was on the lease. That kind of sucked. But I had a little baggie of personal on me, and I knew I could kind of get away with medical marijuana. But if I tried to explain, "Oh, Your Honor, I have to do quality control," I didn't think that would work. So the little baggie of personal wasn't good. I had $1,000 in my pocket, too, and I didn't want to lose that. So anyway, Lars decides he wants to call me into the back room of the store to talk to me. I guess open the safe, that was it. So I went and gave him opened up the safe, and he looked in, there was nothing there. I stashed my little bag of personal in a box when he was doing that, so luckily I got away with that. And then he asked me about the quarter pound in my friend's hand, and I thought, "Oh gee, my name's on the lease, my name's on the warrant. You really want me, I'm going to jail. Sure, Lars, That was mine. It's all mine. Every gram in here. If somebody's got pot in their pocket, I gave it to them, and they owe me for it. Like, and basically just took everything in the store. My friend just walked, right? Like, they searched me, didn't have anything on him. They never followed him up. So, you know, obviously, we, you know, he's not going to stand up in court and say that to the judge, per se. But it was clear that they only wanted to arrest and harass me. Everybody else was let go again, even if they were caught with pot in there. When I got out in the store, I stashed my $1,000 into one of my chairs and was quite nervous when I saw other people after I got searched sitting on the chair. I was just praying that money didn't fall on the floor. That would have really sucked. But that was exactly what my bail was to get out too. So it was kind of cool that that worked out. But yeah, I've had to put $1,000 down to the government just to stay out of jail for the last couple of years since that. Luckily, I haven't been in the store for any of the other police raids. To conclude, the total of 5 police raids we've had now at the Buyers Club. The third one happened after some junkies broke in to steal my legal defense fund. After the second raid, we thought, oh my God, we got all these court charges. We get a water jug, filled it full of pennies, and the weekend that I was going to take it and count it and give it to my lawyer, some shithead broke in the door and stole it. The cops came right after, and when they found it, and one of the people working there showed up, and he kind of let them in and stuff, and when they figured out what was going on in there, they ran in the distribution room, grabbed about a quarter pound and all the cookies they could find, and left before I could even show up. So no one was ever charged with theft or with the cookies or anything like that. It was just the cops and robbers. That was the third raid. The fourth raid, and the charges have been thrown out against Colby for it, were the result of one of the members assaulting someone down the street, basically, and the police were called to the store because of her. And when they came, Colby told them, he's really good at the Jedi mind tricks too. He's basically, you know, we're not open to the public, we're not doing anything wrong here, you can take her and leave now. And while it didn't stop them from getting a warrant the next day, it was enough to convince the judge years later that the police hadn't done enough work to prove that he had any control over the space. And certainly, I don't think anyone can really claim to have control over that place, really. It's disorganized crime at best. And as such, the charges were thrown out against him. Next Thursday is the 1-year anniversary of the last time that Lars had a warrant to raid us. It was with his drug squad that was supposedly cleaning up all the junkies downtown last year. By February, they got bored and they wanted to go after potheads, and they figured we were the first place to go. They, had somebody in Centennial Square, per se, tip them off, they said, and suggest that they bought their pot at our store. We doubt that the person caught in Centennial Square that time was a member of our club. We're quite convinced it was a street dealer who was trying to rat us out so that we would get shut down and they could buy or sell more pot or something like that. But it certainly, to our knowledge, was not a member. But 1 week later, after the drug squad watched us for a full week, they couldn't come up with anything better than to follow a member out of the club and arrest him. They had a van at 7-Eleven with a camera in it, and they just followed him down the street and grabbed him at the bus stop. He had a grandma pot on him. He has a legitimate medical problem. There's no doubt about that. But they kept him in jail for 4 hours. And while he was charged eventually, those charges have been dropped against him. And he wasn't, though, allowed to make a phone call when he was thrown in jail, which not only meant he couldn't call us and give us a warning, but his son was getting out of school a couple hours later. And he was, I think, he's 9 years old, and he was let out of school with his dad supposed to be there. And for 2 hours, he wasn't able to start to deal with that situation. So they really screwed Dennis around there. But the intent was to grab somebody leaving the store, find pot on them, get a warrant. They went and arrested our friends Scott and Ryan. That trial's been delayed till May. So those are all 5 trials. Again, the two that I was arrested in were the first two. I've been lucky enough not to be in the store during any other police raids since then. But when I was getting out of jail for the second police raid, again, the fourth time now that I've been arrested in the past couple of years, the judge, you could say, had a really tough decision to make when she had to decide whether or not I was going to be kept in jail. In fact, it was almost comical before that because Judge Smith, who I'd mentioned earlier, certainly I've seen lots of other court cases in mine, but he was in court in 101 that day as well when I was trying to get out of jail, and he wouldn't let me out of jail. He really hates me, I know it. And in fact, he was having a really busy day in room 101, and so when I got up there the first time at like 10 or 11 in the morning, he looked at his schedule and he thought, oh gee, I don't have time to deal with all this right now, so come back at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and I hope I can deal with you then. But when it came to 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he still was too busy with his work, and so he had to set up a whole courtroom with a judge and security and everything like that just to deal with me and the 30 or 40 people that were there to watch the proceedings. And he was really mad, I think, because he would have kept me in jail, I'm quite sure, no matter how well I could argue my case. And I was quite lucky to have a new judge. One of the things that certainly worked to my benefit was that we had, by that time, over 200 written letters of support from individuals in the community, members of the club, and others for the work that I do. And that was rather daunting for the judge to see, and certainly very helpful in getting me out of jail. Again, though, that was like 2 years ago. It's March, the last time I got out of jail. And what the judge did when she let me out of jail was that she said they would, continue to suspend my criminal trials pending my constitutional ones. But that may, in fact, be changing here. I've talked about tomorrow's court case. I'll remind you all again, we have t-shirts up here for sale. They're only $10. It's the best deal for a great pod t-shirt I think you'll ever get. We hope to have the room full tomorrow with people wearing these shirts. It's at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, which is really nice. We will. They may sell out because there's a lot of people that want them. We only made about 50. So the ones that are left, we'll take them to the courthouse to have for sale out front. We can't sell them in the courthouse itself. So we'll sell them on the sidewalk out front. The t-shirts, if there's any left, will be for sale on the front steps of the courthouse tomorrow. But certainly you'll have to get there early as well. Or you might want to stop by the Buyers Club on Johnson Street there too, if you want to seek that out beforehand, just to make sure you get one. The courtroom isn't very big, so if you want to come see it, it's going to be a short and sweet court hearing, about half an hour maybe. But it certainly will be intense. In fact, as I've said, it's probably the maddest you will ever see a judge in a courtroom in your life. And that's because of a lot of things, not just the fact that I'm going to have a courtroom of people there, and not just the fact that I've been arrested again and again breaking the cannabis laws here. But the judge is even going to be mad this time at the Crown Prosecutor for doing such a poor job, you could say, over time, and not really, you might say, being on the ball here. And the Crown, in fact, is so, I guess, confused about the situation that they're going to ask the judge tomorrow to per se negate the constitutional hearing and go straight into the criminal trials. And that's because the Crown has it in their head that the reason we waited for the Supreme Court of Canada decision that happened this December again was because I had put per se all of my arguments into the Cane Clay and Melvin case, and that if the Supreme Court held the law, the Crown thought that meant that all my constitutional arguments failed. When in fact, it didn't mean that. It just means that some of the arguments, the harm principle arguments, some significant arguments, don't have to be repeated in my case, and that we can build off of the Supreme Court decision. But that's not what the prosecutor thought was going on, and they don't want to have to go through a long and exhaustive process through appeals, dealing with law in theory, and at the end of that, have, per se, the trafficking laws upheld by the courts, and then, after all that, the theory would be, and I could go all the way to the Supreme Court with just that, then we would begin the four criminal trials I have, at the end of which I would still be allowed to argue constitutional issues. And so the Crown realizes that what the judge did in trying to separate my arguments was a lengthy process that was exhaustive, and we believe that it's certainly unfair as well. And so the judge tomorrow is going to be really mad because me, I guess, a corrupt of youth and disrespecter of the gods, is going to be there. I'll be wearing a shirt and tie, but all my friends will be wearing their t-shirts, and there'll be more in the hallway trying to get in. So he'll be really kind of mad at all that, but he'll be mad at the Crown Prosecutor as well, because he tried to deal with this 3 years ago and just shove it along. And 3 years later, the situation, the number of trials, are that much more complicated, that much more complex. And the Crown Prosecutor is basically embarrassing this judge by making him come out into a public courtroom and either explain this complex and arbitrary sort of unusual way that they want to put my court cases through, or the judge is going to be forced to admit, okay, I was wrong in the process that I stepped forward, and we're going to go ahead with the criminal trials, which would mean that I would basically argue with my expert witnesses at the conclusion of all four of the criminal trials, and would bring up my arguments separately as each one went on, and the appeal process would obviously get tied up into it, because if I win, the Crown will appeal. If I lose, I'm going to appeal. There's no doubt of that.